Chapter 14. Real Life is Meeting. 1. Since the day and night of the outer world made no difference in Mark Sell, he did not know whether it was minutes or hours later that he found himself once more awake, once more confronting Frost, and still fasting. The professor came to ask if he had thought over their recent conversation. Mark, who judged that some decent show of reluctances would make his final surrender more convincing, replied that only one thing was still troubling him. He did not quite understand what he in particular, or humanity in general, stood to gain by cooperation with the macrobes. He saw clearly that the motives on which most men act, and which they dignify by the names of patriotism or duty to humanity, were mere products of the animal organism, varying according to the behavior pattern of different communities. But he did not yet see what was to be substituted for these irrational motives. On what ground henceforward were actions to be justified or condemned? "If one insists on putting the question in those terms," said Frost, "I think Waddington has given the best answer. Existence is its own justification. The tendency to develop mental change, which we call evolution, is justified by the fact that it is a general characteristic of biological entities. The present establishment of contact between the highest biological entities and the macrobes is justified by the fact that it is occurring, and it ought to be increased, because an increase is taking place." "You think, then," said Mark, "that there would be no sense in asking whether the general tendency of the universe might be in the direction we should call bad?" "There could be no sense at all," said Frost. "The judgment you are trying to make turns out on inspection to be simply an expression of emotion. Huxley himself could only express it by using emotive terms such as gladiatorial or ruthless. I am referring to the famous Roman lecture. When the so-called struggle for existence is seen simply as an actuarial theorem, we have, in Waddington's words, a concept as unemotional as a definite integral, and the emotion disappears. With it disappears that preposterous idea of an external standard of value which the emotion produced." "And the actual tendency of events," said Mark, "would still be self-justified, and in that sense good, when it was working for the extinction of all organic life, as it presently will." "Of course," replied Frost, "if you insist on formulating the problem in those terms. In reality, the question is meaningless. It presupposes a means and ends pattern of thought which descends from Aristotle, who in his turn was merely hypostasizing elements in the experience of an Iron Age agricultural community. Motives are not the causes of action, but its byproducts. You are merely wasting your time by considering them. When you have attained real objectivity, you will recognize not some motives, but all motives as merely animal, subjective epiphenomena. You will then have no motives, and you will find that you do not need them. Their place will be supplied by something else, which you will presently understand better than you do now. So far from being impoverished, your action will become much more efficient."
"I see," said Mark.
The philosophy which Frost was expounding was by no means unfamiliar to him. He recognized it at once as the logical conclusion of thoughts which he had always hitherto accepted, and which at this moment he found himself irrevocably rejecting. The knowledge that his own assumptions led to Frost's position, combined with what he saw in Frost's face and what he had experienced in this very cell, effected a complete conversion. All the philosophers and evangelists in the world might not have done the job so neatly. "And that," continued Frost, "is why a systematic training in objectivity must be given to you. Its purpose is to eliminate from your mind one by one the things you have hitherto regarded as grounds for action. It is like killing a nerve. That whole system of instinctive preferences, whatever ethical, aesthetic, or logical disguise they wear, is to be simply destroyed."
"I get the idea," said Mark, though with an inward reservation that his present instinctive desire to batter the professor's face into a jelly would take a good deal of destroying.
After that, Frost took Mark from the cell and gave him a meal in some neighbouring room. It was also lit by artificial light and had no window. The professor stood perfectly still and watched him while he ate. Mark did not know what the food was and did not much like it, but he was far too hungry by now to refuse it, if refusal had been possible. When the meal was over, Frost led him to the anteroom of the head, and once more he was stripped and reclothed in surgeon's overalls and a mask. Then he was brought in, into the presence of the gaping and dribbling head. To his surprise, Frost took not the slightest notice of it.
He led him across the room to a narrower little door with a pointed arch in the far wall. Here he paused and said, "Go in. You will speak to no one of what you find here. I will return presently." Then he opened the door and Mark went in. The room, at first sight, was an anticlimax. It appeared to be an empty committee room with a long table, 8 or 9 chairs, some pictures, and, oddly enough, a large stepladder in one corner. Here also there were no windows. It was lit by an electric light which produced, better than Mark had ever seen it produced before, the illusion of daylight, of a cold, grey place out of doors. This, combined with the absence of a fireplace, made it seem chilly, though the temperature was not, in fact, very low. A man of trained sensibility would have seen at once that the room was ill-proportioned, not grotesquely so, but sufficient to produce dislike. It was too high and too narrow. Mark felt the effect without analysing the cause, and the effect grew on him as time passed. Sitting staring about him, he next noticed the door, and thought at first that he was the victim of some optical illusion. It took him quite a long time to prove to himself that he was not. The point of the arch was not in the centre. The whole thing was lopsided. Once again, the error was not gross. The thing was near enough to the true to deceive you for a moment, and to go on teasing the mind even after the deception had been unmasked. Involuntarily, one kept shifting the head to find positions from which it would look right after all. He turned round and sat with his back to it. One mustn't let it become an obsession. Then he noticed the spots on the ceiling. They were not mere specks of dirt or discoloration, they were deliberately painted on. Little round black spots placed at irregular intervals on the pale mustard-coloured surface. There were not a great many of them, perhaps 30, or was it 100? He determined that he would not fall into the trap of trying to count them. They would be hard to count, they were so irregularly placed. Or weren't they? Now that his eyes were growing used to them, and one couldn't help noticing that there were 5 in that little group to the right, their arrangement seemed to hover on the verge of regularity. They suggested some kind of pattern. Their peculiar ugliness consisted in the very fact that they kept on suggesting it and then frustrating the expectation thus aroused. Suddenly he realized that this was another trap. He fixed his eyes on the table. There were spots on the table, too, white ones, shiny white spots, not quite round, and arranged, apparently, to correspond to the spots on the ceiling. Or were they? No, of course not. Ah, now he had it. The pattern, if you could call it a pattern, on the table was an exact reversal of that on the ceiling, but with certain exceptions. He found he was glancing rapidly from one to the other, trying to puzzle it out. For the third time he checked himself. He got up and began to walk about. He had a look at the pictures. Some of them belonged to a school of art with which he was already familiar. There was a portrait of a young woman who held her mouth wide open to reveal the fact that the inside of it was thickly overgrown with hair. It was very skillfully painted in the photographic manner so that you could almost feel that hair. Indeed, you could not avoid feeling it, however hard you tried. There was a giant mantis playing a fiddle while being eaten by another mantis, and a man with corkscrews instead of arms bathing in a flat, sadly coloured sea beneath a summer sunset. But most of the pictures were not of this kind. At first, most of them seemed rather ordinary, though Mark was a little surprised at the predominance of scriptural themes. It was only at the second or third glance that one discovered certain unaccountable details, something odd about the positions of the figures' feet, or the arrangement of their fingers, or the grouping. And who was the person standing between Christ and the Lazarus? And why were there so many beetles under the table in the Last Supper? What was the curious trick of lighting that made each picture look like something seen in delirium? When once these questions had been raised, the apparent ordinariness of the pictures became their supreme menace, like the ominous surface innocence at the beginning of certain dreams. Every fold of drapery, every piece of architecture, had a meaning one could not grasp, but which withered the mind. Compared with these, the other surrealistic pictures were mere foolery. Long ago, Mark had read somewhere of things of that extreme evil which seem innocent to the uninitiate, and had wondered what sort of things they might be. Now he felt he knew. He turned his back on the pictures and sat down. He understood the whole business now. Frost was not trying to make him insane, at least not in the sense Mark had hitherto given to the word insanity. Frost had meant what he said. To sit in the room was the first step towards what Frost called objectivity, the process whereby all specifically human reactions were killed in a man so that he might become fit for the fastidious society of the macrobes. Higher degrees in the asceticism of anti-nature would doubtless follow, the eating of abominable food, the dabbling in dirt and blood, the ritual performances of calculated obscenities. They were, in a sense, playing quite fair with him, offering him the very same initiation through which they themselves had passed and which had divided them from humanity, distending and dissipating wither into a shapeless ruin, while it condensed and sharpened frost into the hard, bright little needle that he now was. But after an hour or so this long, high coffin of a room began to produce on Mark an effect which his instructor had probably not anticipated. There was no return of the attack which he had suffered last night in the cell. Whether because he had already survived that attack, or because the imminence of death had drawn the tooth of his lifelong desire for the esoteric, or because he had, in a fashion, called very urgently for help, the built and painted perversity of this room had the effect of making him aware, as he had never been aware before, of this room's opposite. As the desert first teaches men to love water, or as absence first reveals affection, there rose up against this background of the sour and the crooked some kind of vision of the sweet and the straight. Something else, something he vaguely called the normal, apparently existed. He had never thought about it before, but there it was, solid, massive, with a shape of its own, almost like something you could touch or eat or fall in love with. It was all mixed up with Jane and fried eggs and soap and sunlight and the rooks cawing at Cure Hardy and the thought that somewhere outside daylight was going on at that moment. He was not thinking in moral terms at all, or else, what is much the same thing, he was having his first deeply moral experience. He was choosing a side, the normal. All that, as he called it, was what he chose. If the scientific point of view led away from all that, then be damned to the scientific point of view. The vehemence of his choice almost took his breath away. He had not had such a sensation before. For the moment he hardly cared if frost and wither killed him. I do not know how long this mood would have lasted, but while it was still at its height frost returned. He led Mark to a bedroom where a fire blazed and an old man lay in bed. The light gleaming on glasses and silver and the soft luxury of the room so raised Mark's spirits that he found it difficult to listen while Frost told him that he must remain here on duty till relieved and must ring up the deputy director if the patient spoke or stirred. He himself was to say nothing. Indeed, it would be useless if he did, for the patient did not understand English. Frost retired. Mark glanced around the room. He was reckless now. He saw no possibility of leaving Belbury alive unless he allowed himself to be made into a dehumanized servant of the macrobes. Meanwhile, do or die for it, he was going to have a meal. There were all sorts of delights on that table. Perhaps a smoke first, with his feet on the fender. "Damn," he said, as he put his hand into his pocket and found it empty. At the same moment he noticed that the man in the bed had opened his eyes and was looking at him. "I'm sorry," said Mark. "I didn't mean—" and then stopped. The man sat up in bed and jerked his head towards the door. "Eh?" he said inquiringly. "I beg your pardon?" said Mark. "Eh?" said the man again, and then, "Foreigners, eh?" "You do speak English, then?" said Mark. "Ah," said the man. After a pause of several seconds, he said, "Governor?" Mark looked at him. "Governor," repeated the patient with great energy. "You ain't got such a thing as a bit of baccy about you, eh?"
2. "I think that's all we can do for the present," said Mother Dimble. "We'll do the flowers this afternoon." She was speaking to Jane, and both were in what was called the lodge, a little stone house beside the garden door at which Jane had been first admitted to the manor. Mrs. Dimble and Jane had been preparing it for the Maggs family. For Mr. Magg's sentence expired today, and Ivy had gone off by train the previous afternoon to spend the night with an aunt in the town where he was imprisoned, and to meet him at the prison gate. When Mrs. Dimble had told her husband how she would be engaged that morning, he had said,
"Well, it can't take you very long just lighting a fire and making a bed."
I share Dr. Dimble's sex and his limitation. I have no idea what the two women found to do in the lodge for all the hours they spent there. Even Jane had hardly anticipated it. In Mrs. Dimble's hands, the task of airing the little house and making the bed for Ivy Maggs and her jailbird husband became something between a game and a ritual.
It woke in Jane vague memories of helping at Christmas or Easter decorations in church when she had been a small child. But it also suggested to her literary memory all sorts of things out of 16th-century epithalamiums, age-old superstitions, jokes and sentimentalities about bridal beds and marriage bowers, with omens at the threshold and fairies upon the hearth. It was an atmosphere extraordinarily alien to that in which she had grown up. A few weeks ago she would have disliked it. Was there not something absurd about that stiff, twinkling, archaic world, the mixture of prudery and sensuality, the stylized ardours of the groom and the conventional bashfulness of the bride, the religious sanction, the permitted solacities of Fescennine song, and the suggestion that everyone except the principals might be expected to be rather tipsy? How had the human race ever come to imprison in such a ceremony the most unceremonious thing in the world? But she was no longer sure of her reaction. What she was sure of was the dividing line that included Mother Dimble in that world and left her outside. Mother Dimble, for all her 19th-century propriety, or perhaps because of it, struck her this afternoon as being herself an archaic person. At every moment she seemed to join hands with some solemn yet roguish company of busy old women who had been tucking young lovers into bed since the world began, with an incongruous mixture of nods and winks and blessings and tears. Quite impossible old women in ruffs or wimples who would be making Shakespearean jokes about codpieces and cuckoldry at one moment and kneeling devoutly at altars the next. It was very odd, for of course, as far as their conversation was concerned, the difference between them was reversed. Jane, in a literary argument, could have talked about codpieces with great sang-froid, while Mother Dimble was an Edwardian lady who would simply have ignored such a subject out of existence if any modernized booby had been so unfortunate as to raise it in her presence. Perhaps the weather had some bearing on Jane's curious sensations. The frost had ended, and it was one of those days of almost piercingly sweet mildness which sometimes occur in the very beginning of winter. Ivy had discussed her own story with Jane only the day before. Mr. Maggs had stolen some money from the laundry that he worked for. He had done this before he met Ivy, and at a time when he had got into bad company. Since he and Ivy had started going out together, he had gone as straight as straight. But the little crime had been unearthed and come out of the past to catch him, and he had been arrested about 6 weeks after their marriage. Jane had said very little during the telling of the story. Ivy had not seemed conscious of the purely social stigma attaching to petty theft and a term of imprisonment, so that Jane would have had no opportunity to practice, even if she had wished, that almost technical kindness which some people reserve for the sorrows of the poor. On the other hand, she was given no chance to be revolutionary or speculative, to suggest that theft was no more criminal than all wealth was criminal. Ivy seemed to take traditional morality for granted. She had been ever so upset about it. It seemed to matter a great deal in one way, and not to matter at all in another. It had never occurred to her that it should alter her relations with her husband, as though theft, like ill health, were one of the normal risks one took in getting married. "I always say you can't expect to know everything about a boy till you're married, not really," she had said. "I suppose not," said Jane. "Of course it's the same for them," added Ivy. "My old dad used often to say that he'd never have married Mum, not if he'd known how she snored. And she said herself, 'No, Dad, that you wouldn't.'" "Well, that's rather different, I suppose."
"Well, what I say is, if it wasn't one thing, it'd be something else. That's how I look at it. And it isn't as if they hadn't got a lot to put up with, too, because they've sort of got to get married, if they're the right sort, poor things. But whatever we say, Jane, a woman takes a lot of living with. I don't mean what you'd call a bad woman. I remember one day, it was before you came, Mother Dimble was saying something to the doctor, and there he was sitting reading something, you know, the way he does, with his fingers under some of the pages and a pencil in his hand, not the way you or I'd read, and he just said, 'Yes, dear,' and we both of us knew he hadn't been listening, and I said, 'There you are, Mother Dimble,' said I, 'that's how they treat us once they're married. They don't even listen to what we say,' I said. And do you know what she said? 'Ivy Maggs,' said she, 'did it ever come into your mind to ask whether anyone could listen to all we say?' Those were her very words. Of course, I wasn't going to give in to it, not before him, so I said, 'Yes, they could.' But it was a fair knockout. You know, often I've been talking to my husband for a long time, and he's looked up and asked me what I've been saying, and, you know, I haven't been able to remember myself."
"Well, that's different," said Jane. "It's when people drift apart, take up quite different opinions, join different sides." "You must be ever so anxious about Mr. Studdock," replied Ivy. "I'd never be able to sleep a wink if I were in your shoes. But the director'll bring it all right in the end. You see if he don't."
Mrs. Dimble went back to the house presently to fetch some little nicety which would put the finishing touch to the bedroom in the lodge. Jane, feeling a little tired, knelt on the window-seat and put her elbows on the sill and her chin in her hands. The sun was almost hot. The thought of going back to Mark, if Mark were ever rescued from Belbury, was one which her mind had long accepted. It was not horrifying to her, but flat and insipid. It was not the less so because at this moment she fully forgave him for his conjugal crime of sometimes apparently preferring her person to her conversation, and sometimes his own thoughts to both. Why should anyone be particularly interested in what she said? This new humility would even have been pleasant to her if it had been directed to anyone more exciting than Mark. She must, of course, be very different with him when they met again. But it was that again which so took the savour out of the good resolution, like going back to a sum one had already got wrong and working it out afresh on the same scrawled page of the exercise book. If they met again. She felt guilty at her lack of anxiety. Almost the same moment, she found that she was a little anxious. For hitherto she had always somehow assumed that Mark would come back. The possibility of his death now presented itself. She had no direct emotions about herself living afterwards. She just saw the image of Mark dead, that face dead in the middle of a pillow, that whole body rigid, those hands and arms, for good and ill so different from all other hands and arms, stretched out straight and useless like a doll's. She felt very cold. Yet the sun was hotter than ever, almost impossibly hot for the time of year. It was very still, too, so still that she could hear the movements of a small bird which was hopping along the path outside the window. This path led to the door in the garden wall by which she had first entered. The bird hopped onto the threshold of that door and onto someone's foot, for now Jane saw that someone was sitting on a little seat just inside the door. This person was only a few yards away, and she must have been sitting very quiet for Jane not to have noticed her. A flame-coloured robe, in which her hands were hidden, covered this person from the feet to where it rose behind her neck in a kind of high, ruff-like collar, but in front it was so low or open that it exposed her large breasts. Her skin was darkish and southern and glowing, almost the colour of honey. Some such dress Jane had seen worn by a Minoan priestess on a vase from old Knossos. The head, poised motionless on the muscular pillar of her neck, stared straight at Jane. It was a red-cheeked, wet-lipped face, with black eyes, almost the eyes of a cow, and an enigmatic expression. It was not by ordinary standards at all like the face of Mother Dimble, but Jane recognised it at once. It was, to speak like the musicians, the full statement of that theme which had elusively haunted Mother Dimble's face for the last few hours. It was Mother Dimble's face with something left out, and the omission shocked Jane. It is brutal, she thought, for its energy crushed her. But then she half changed her mind and thought, it is I who am weak, trumpery. It is mocking me, she thought, but then once more changed her mind and thought, it is ignoring me, it doesn't see me. For though there was an almost ogreish glee in the face, Jane did not seem to be invited to share the joke. She tried to look aside from the face, succeeded, and saw for the first time that there were other creatures present, four or five of them. No, more. A whole crowd of ridiculous little men, fat dwarfs in red caps with tassels on them, chubby, gnome-like little men, quite insufferably familiar, frivolous, and irrepressible. For there was no doubt that they, at any rate, were mocking her. They were pointing at her, nodding, mimicking, standing on their heads, turning somersaults. Jane was not yet frightened, partly because the extreme warmth of the air at this open window made her feel drowsy. It was really quite ridiculous for the time of year. Her main feeling was one of indignation. A suspicion which had crossed her mind once or twice before now returned to her with irresistible force, the suspicion that the real universe might be simply silly. It was closely mixed up with the memories of that grown-up laughter, loud, careless, masculine laughter on the lips of bachelor uncles, which had often infuriated her in childhood, and from which the intense seriousness of her school debating society had offered such a grateful escape. But a moment later she was very frightened indeed. The giantess rose. They were all coming at her. With a great glow and a noise like fire, the flame-robed woman and the malapert dwarfs had all come into the house. They were in the room with her.
The strange woman had a torch in her hand. It burned with a terrible blinding brightness, crackling, and sent up a cloud of dense black smoke and filled the bedroom with a sticky, resinous smell. If they're not careful, thought Jane, they'll set the house on fire. But she had hardly time to think of that, for her whole attention was fixed by the outrageous behaviour of the little men. They began making hay of the room. In a few seconds the bed was a mere chaos, the sheets on the floor, the blankets snatched up and used by the dwarfs for tossing the fattest of their company, the pillows hurtling through the air, feathers flying everywhere. Look out, can't you?" shouted Jane, for the giantess was beginning to touch various parts of the room with her torch. She touched a vase on the mantelpiece. Instantly there rose from it a streak of colour which Jane took for fire. She was just moving to try to put it out when she saw that the same thing had happened to a picture on the wall. And then it happened faster and faster all round her. The very top-knots of the dwarfs were now on fire. But just as the terror of this became unbearable, Jane noticed that what was curling up from everything the torch had touched was not flame, after all, but vegetation. Ivy and honeysuckle was growing up the legs of the bed, red roses were sprouting from the caps of the little men, and from every direction huge lilies rose to her knees and waist, shooting out their yellow tongues at her. The smells, the heat, the crowding, and the strangeness made her feel faint. It never occurred to her to think she was dreaming. People mistake dreams for visions. No one ever mistook a vision for a dream.
"Jane, Jane," said the voice of Mrs. Dimble suddenly, "what on earth is the matter?"
Jane sat up. The room was empty, but the bed had all been pulled to pieces. She had apparently been lying on the floor. She felt cold and very tired.
"What has happened?" repeated Mrs. Dimble.
"I don't know," said Jane.
"Are you ill, child?" asked Mother Dimble.
"I must see the director at once," said Jane. "It's all right, don't bother. I can get up by myself, really. But I'd like to see the director at once."
3. Mr. Bultitude's mind was as furry and as unhuman in shape as his body. He did not remember, as a man in his situation would have remembered, the provincial zoo from which he had escaped during a fire. Not his first snarling and terrified arrival at the manor, not the slow stages whereby he had learned to love and trust its inhabitants. He did not know that he loved and trusted them now. He did not know that they were people, nor that he was a bear. Indeed, he did not know that he existed at all. Everything that is represented by the words I and me and thou was absent from his mind. When Mrs. Maggs gave him a tin of golden syrup, as she did every Sunday morning, he did not recognize either a giver or a recipient. Goodness occurred, and he tasted it, and that was all. Hence his loves might, if you wished, be all described as cupboard loves. Food and warmth, hands that caressed, voices that reassured, were their objects. But if by a cupboard love you meant something cold or calculating, you would be quite misunderstanding the real quality of the beast's sensations. He was no more like a human egoist than he was like a human altruist. There was no prose in his life. The appetences which a human mind might disdain as cupboard loves were for him quivering and ecstatic aspirations which absorbed his whole being, infinite yearnings stabbed with the threat of tragedy and shot through with the colours of paradise. One of our race, if plunged back for a moment in the warm, trembling, iridescent pool of that pre-Adamite consciousness, would have emerged believing that he had grasped the absolute. For the states below reason and the states above it have, by their common contrast to the life we know, a certain superficial resemblance. Sometimes there returns to us from infancy the memory of a nameless delight or terror, unattached to any delightful or dreadful thing, a potent adjective floating in a nounless void, a pure quality. At such moments we have experience of the shallows of that pool. But fathoms deeper than any memory can take us, right down in the central warmth and dimness, the bear lived all its life.
Today an unusual thing had happened to him. He had got out into the garden without being muzzled. He was always muzzled out of doors, not because there was any fear of his becoming dangerous, but because of his partiality for fruit and for the sweeter kinds of vegetables. "It isn't that he's not tame," as Ivy Maggs had explained to Jane Studdock, "but that he isn't honest. He wouldn't leave us a thing if we let him have the run of his teeth." But today the precaution had been forgotten, and the bear had passed a very agreeable morning investigating the turnips. Now, in the early afternoon, he had approached the garden wall. There was a chestnut tree within the wall which the bear could easily climb, and from its branches he could drop down on the far side.
He was standing looking up at this tree. Mrs. Maggs would have described his state of mind by saying, "He knows perfectly well he's not allowed out of the garden." But that was not how it appeared to Mr. Bultitude. He had no morals. But the director had given him certain inhibitions. A mysterious reluctance arose, a clouding of the emotional weather when the wall was too close. But mixed with this, there was an opposite impulse to get beyond that wall. He did not, of course, know why, and was incapable even of raising the question. If the pressure behind this impulse could be translated into human terms at all, it would appear as something more like a mythology than a thought. One met bees in the garden, but never found a beehive. The bees all went away over the wall. And to follow bees was the obvious thing to do. I think there was a sense in the bear's mind, one could hardly call it a picture, of endless green lands beyond the wall, and hives innumerable, and bees the size of sparrows, and waiting there, or else walking, trickling, oozing to meet one, something or someone stickier, sweeter, more golden than honey itself. Today this unrest was upon him in an unusual degree. He was missing Ivy Maggs. He did not know that there was any such person, and he did not remember her as we know remembering. But there was an unspecified lack in his experience. She and the director were, in their different ways, the two main factors in his existence. He felt, in his own fashion, the supremacy of the director. Meetings with him were, to the bear, what mystical experiences are to men, for the director had brought back with him from Venus some shadow of man's lost prerogative to ennoble beasts. In his presence, Mr. Bultitude trembled on the very borders of personality, thought the unthinkable and did the impossible, was troubled and enraptured with gleams from beyond his own woolly world, and came away tired. But with Ivy he was perfectly at home, as a savage who believes in some remote high god is more at home with the little deities of wood and water. It was Ivy who fed him, chased him out of forbidden places, cuffed him, and talked to him all day long. It was her firm conviction that the creature understood every word she said. If you took this literally, it was untrue, but in another sense it was not so wide of the mark. For much of Ivy's conversation was the expression not of thought, but of feeling, and of feelings Mr. Bultitude almost shared, feelings of alacrity, snugness, and physical affection. In their own way, they understood one another pretty well. 3 times Mr. Bultitude turned away from the tree and the wall, but each time he came back. Then, very cautiously and quietly, he began to climb the tree. When he got up into the fork, he sat there for a long time. He saw beneath him a steep grassy bank descending to a road. The desire and the inhibition were now both very strong. He sat there for nearly half an hour. Sometimes his mind wandered from the point, and once he nearly went to sleep. In the end, he got down on the outside of the wall. When he found that the thing had really happened, he became so frightened that he sat still at the bottom of the grassy bank on the very edge of the road. Then he heard a noise. A motor van came into sight. It was driven by a man in the livery of the NICE, and another man in the same livery sat beside him. "Hello, I say," said the second man. "Pull up, Sid. What about that?" "What?" said the driver. "Haven't you got eyes in your head?" said the other. "Gore," said Sid, pulling up. "Bloody great bear. I say, it couldn't be our own bear, could it?" "Oh, get on," said his mate. "She was in her cage all right this morning. We don't think she could have done a bunk. They'd be able to pay for you and me." "Well, she couldn't have got here if she had done a bunk. Bears don't go 40 miles an hour. That ain't the point. But hadn't we better pinch this one?" "Well, we haven't got no orders," said Sid. "No, and we haven't failed to get that blasted wolf either, have we?" "Well, wasn't our fault. The old woman what said she'd sell wouldn't sell, as you're there to witness, young Len. We did our best. Told her that experiments at Belbury weren't what she thought. Told her the brute would have the time of its life and be made no end of a pet. Never told so many lies in one morning in my life. She'd been got at by someone." "Of course it wasn't our fault, but the boss won't take no notice of that. It's get on or get out at Belbury."
"Get out," said Sid. "I wish to hell I knew how."
Len spat over the side, and there was a moment's silence. "Anyway," said Sid presently, "what's the good of taking a bear back?"
"Well, isn't it better than coming back with nothing?" said Len. "And bears cost money. I know they want another one, and here it is free."
"All right," said Rid ironically. "If you're so keen on it, just hop out and ask him to step in."
"Dope,"
said Len. "Well, not on my bit of dinner, you don't.
said Sid. "Well, you're a bucking good mate to have," said Len, groping in a greasy parcel. "It's a good thing for you I'm not the sort of chap who'd split on you." "Well, you've done it already," said the driver. "I know all your little games."
Len had by this time produced a thick sandwich and was dabbing it with some strong-smelling liquid from a bottle. When it was thoroughly saturated, he opened the door and went a pace forward, still holding the door in one hand. He was now about 6 yards from the bear, which had remained perfectly still ever since it saw them. He threw the sandwich to it. Quarter of an hour later, Mr. Bultitude lay on his side, unconscious and breathing heavily. They had no difficulty in tying up his mouth and all four paws, but they had great difficulty in lifting him into the van.
"Well, that's done something to my ticker," said Sid, pressing his hand to his left side. "Oh, curse your ticker," said Len, rubbing the sweat out of his eyes. "Come on."
Sid climbed back into the driving seat, sat still for a few seconds, panting and muttering, "Christ," at intervals. Then he started his engine up and they drove away. 4. For some time now, Mark's waking life was divided between periods by the sleeper's bedside and periods in the room with the spotted ceiling. The training in objectivity which took place in the latter cannot be described fully. The reversal of natural inclination which Frost inculcated was not spectacular or dramatic, but the details would be unprintable, and had, indeed, a kind of nursery fatuity about them which is best ignored. Often Mark felt that one good roar of coarse laughter would have blown away the whole atmosphere of the thing, but laughter was unhappily out of the question. There indeed lay the horror, to perform petty obscenities which a very silly child might have thought funny, all under the unchangingly serious inspection of Frost, with a stopwatch and a notebook and all the ritual of scientific experiment. Some of the things he had to do were merely meaningless. In one exercise he had to mount the stepladder and touch some one spot on the ceiling, selected by Frost. Just touch it with his forefinger and then come down again. But either by association with the other exercises, or because it really concealed some significance, this proceeding always appeared to Mark to be the most indecent and even inhuman of all his tasks. And day by day, as the process went on, that idea of the straight or the normal which had occurred to him during his first visit to this room grew stronger and more solid in his mind, till it had become a kind of mountain. He had never before known what an idea meant. He had always thought till now that they were things inside one's own head. But now, when his head was continually attacked and often completely filled with the clinging corruption of the training, this idea towered up above him. Something which obviously existed quite independently of himself and had hard rock surfaces which would not give, surfaces he could cling to. The other thing that helped to save him was the man in the bed. Mark's discovery that he really could speak English had led to a curious acquaintance with him. It can hardly be said that they conversed. Both spoke, but the result was hardly conversation as Mark had hitherto understood the term. The man was so very elusive and used gesture so extensively that Mark's less sophisticated modes of communication were almost useless. Thus, when Mark explained that he had no tobacco, the man had slapped an imaginary tobacco pouch on his knee at least 6 times and struck an imaginary match about as often, each time jerking his head sideways with a look of such relish as Mark had seldom seen on a human face. Then Mark went on to explain that though they were not foreigners, they were extremely dangerous people, and that probably the stranger's best plan would be to preserve his silence.
"Ah," said the stranger, jerking his head again. "Ah, eh?"
And then, without exactly laying his finger on his lips, he went through an elaborate pantomime which clearly meant the same thing. And it was impossible for a long time to get him off this subject. He went back and back to the theme of secrecy.
"Ah," he said, "don't get nothing out of me, I tell 'ee. Don't get nothing out of me, eh? I tell 'ee. You and me knows, eh?"
And his look embraced Mark in such an apparently gleeful conspiracy that it warmed the heart. Believing this matter to be now sufficiently clear, Mark began, "But as regards the future," only to be met by another pantomime of secrecy followed by the word,
"Eh?"
in a tone which demanded an answer. "Yes, of course," said Mark. "We are both in considerable danger, and—"
"Ah," said the man. "Foreigners, eh?"
"No, no," said Mark. "I told you they weren't. They seem to think you are, though, and that's why—"
"That's right," interrupted the man. "I know. Foreigners, I call 'em. I know. They get nothing out of me. You and me's all right. Ah!" I've been trying to think out some sort of plan, said Mark.
Ah, said the man approvingly.
And I was wondering, began Mark, when the man suddenly leaned forwards and said with extraordinary energy,
I tell ye.
What? Said Mark.
I got a plan.
What is it?
Ah,
said the man, winking at Mark with infinite knowingness and rubbing his belly.
Well, go on, what is it? Said Mark.
How'd it be? Said the man, sitting up and applying his left thumb to his right forefinger as if about to propound the first step in a philosophical argument. How'd it be now if you and I made ourselves a nice bit of toasted cheese?
I meant a plan for escape, said Mark.
Ah, replied the man. My old dad now. He never had a day's illness in his life, eh? How's that for a bit of all right, eh?
It's a remarkable record, said Mark.
Ah, you may say so, replied the other. On the road all his life, never had a stomachache, eh?
And here, as if Mark might not know that malady, he went through a long, extraordinarily vivid dumb show. Open-air life suited him, I suppose, said Mark.
And what did he attribute his health to? Asked the man.
He pronounced the word attribute with great relish, laying the accent on the first syllable.
I ask everyone, what did he attribute his health to?
Mark was about to reply, when the man indicated by a gesture that the question was purely rhetorical, and that he did not wish to be interrupted.
He attributed his health, continued the speaker with great solemnity, to eating toasted cheese. Keeps the water out of the stomach, that's what it does, eh? Makes a lining, stands to reason, eh?
In several later interviews, Mark endeavoured to discover something of the stranger's own history, and particularly how he had been brought to Belbury. This was not easy to do, for though the tramp's conversation was very autobiographical, it was filled almost entirely with accounts of conversations in which he had made stunning repartees whose points remained wholly obscure. Even where it was less intellectual in character, the allusions were too difficult for Mark, who was quite ignorant of the life of the roads, though he had once written a very authoritative article on vagrancy. But by repeated and, as he got to know his man, more cautious questioning, he couldn't help getting the idea that the tramp had been made to give up his clothes to a total stranger and then put to sleep. He never got the story in so many words. The tramp insisted on talking as if Mark knew it already, and any pressure for a more accurate account produced only a series of nods, winks, and highly confidential gestures. As for the identity or appearance of the person who had taken his clothes, nothing whatever could be made out. The nearest Mark ever got to it, after hours of talk and deep potations, was some such statement as,
"Ah, he was a one," or, "He was a kind of, well, you know," or, "That was a customer, that was."
These statements were made with enormous gusto, as though the theft of the tramp's clothes had excited his deepest admiration. Indeed, throughout the man's conversation, this gusto was the most striking characteristic. He never passed any kind of moral judgment on the various things that had been done to him in the course of his career, nor did he even try to explain them. Much that was unjust, and still more that was simply unintelligible, seemed to be accepted not only without resentment, but with a certain satisfaction, provided only that it was striking. Even about his present situation, he showed very much less curiosity than Mark would have thought possible. It did not make sense. But then the man did not expect things to make sense. He deplored the absence of tobacco and regarded the foreigners as very dangerous people. But the main thing, obviously, was to eat and drink as much as possible while the present conditions lasted. And gradually Mark fell into line. The man's breath, and indeed his body, were malodorous, and his methods of eating were gross. But the sort of continual picnic which the two shared carried Mark back into the realm of childhood which we have all enjoyed before nicety began. Each understood perhaps an eighth part of what the other said, but a kind of intimacy grew between them. Mark never noticed until years later that here, where there was no room for vanity and no more power or security than that of children playing in a giant's kitchen, he had unawares become a member of a circle as secret and as strongly fenced against outsiders as any that he had dreamed of. Every now and then their tête-à-tête was interrupted. Frost or Wither or both would come in, introducing some stranger who addressed the tramp in an unknown language, failed completely to get any response, and was ushered out again. The tramp's habit of submission to the unintelligible, mixed with a kind of animal cunning, stood him in good stead during these interviews.
Even without Mark's advice, it would never have occurred to him to undeceive his captors by replying in English. Undeceiving was an activity wholly foreign to his mind. For the rest, his expression of tranquil indifference varied occasionally by extremely sharp looks, but never by the least sign of anxiety or bewilderment, left his interrogators mystified. Wither could never find in his face the evil he was looking for, but neither could he find any of that virtue which would, for him, have been the danger signal. The tramp was a type of man he had never met. The dupe, the terrified victim, the toady, the would-be accomplice, the rival, the honest man with loathing and hatred in his eyes were all familiar to him. But not this. And then one day there came an interview that was different. 5. "It sounds rather like a mythological picture by Titian come to life," said the director with a smile when Jane had described her experience in the lodge.
"Yes, but," said Jane, and then stopped. "I see," she began again. "It was very like that. Not only the woman and the dwarfs, but the glow, as if the air were on fire. But I always thought I liked Titian. I suppose I wasn't really taking the pictures seriously enough, just chattering about the Renaissance the way one did." "You didn't like it when it came out into real life." Jane shook her head. "Was it real, sir?" she asked presently. "Are there such things?" "Yes," said the director. "It was real enough. Oh, there are thousands of things within this square mile that I don't know about yet, and I dare say that the presence of Merlinus brings out certain things. We are not living exactly in the 20th century as long as he's here. We overlap a bit. The focus is blurred, and you yourself, you are a seer. You were perhaps bound to meet her. She's what you'll get if you won't have the other."
"How do you mean, sir?" said Jane.
"You said she was a little like Mother Dimble. So she is. But Mother Dimble with something left out. Mother Dimble is friends with all that world, as Merlinus is friends with the woods and rivers. But he isn't a wood or a river himself. She has not rejected it, but she has baptized it. She is a Christian wife, and you know, are not. Neither are you a virgin. You have put yourself where you must meet that old woman, and you have rejected all that has happened to her since Maleldil came to earth. So you get her raw. Not stronger than Mother Dimble would find her, but untransformed, demoniac, and you don't like it. Hasn't that been the history of your life?"
"You mean," said Jane slowly, "I've been repressing something?"
The director laughed, just that loud, assured bachelor laughter which had often infuriated her on other lips. "Yes," he said, "but don't think I'm talking of Freudian repressions. He knew only half the facts. It isn't a question of inhibitions, inculcated shame against natural desire. I'm afraid there's no niche in the world for people that won't be either pagan or Christian. Just imagine a man who was too dainty to eat with his fingers and yet wouldn't use forks." His laughter, rather than his words, had reddened Jane's cheeks, and she was staring at him open-mouthed. Assuredly, the director was not in the least like Mother Dimble, but an odious realization that he was, in this matter, on Mother Dimble's side, that he also, though he did not belong to that hot-coloured, archaic world, stood somehow in good diplomatic relations with it, from which she was excluded, had struck her like a blow. Some old female dream of finding a man who really understood was being insulted. She took it for granted, half unconsciously, that the director was the most virginal of his sex. But she had not realized that this would leave his masculinity still on the other side of the stream from herself, and even steeper, more emphatic than that of common men. Some knowledge of a world beyond nature she had already gained from living in his house, and more from fear of death that night in the dingle. But she had been conceiving this world as spiritual, in the negative sense, as some neutral or democratic vacuum where differences disappeared, where sex and sense were not transcended, but simply taken away. Now the suspicion dawned upon her that there might be differences and contrasts all the way up, richer, sharper, even fiercer, at every rung of the ascent. How, if this invasion of her own being in marriage, from which she had recoiled, often in the very teeth of instinct, were not, as she had supposed, merely a relic of animal life or patriarchal barbarism, but rather the lowest, the first, and the easiest form of some shocking contact with reality which would have to be repeated, but in ever larger and more disturbing modes, on the highest levels of all. "Yes,"
said the director. "There is no escape. If it were a virginal rejection of the male, he would allow it. Such souls can bypass the male and go on to meet something far more masculine, higher up, to which they must make a yet deeper surrender. But your trouble has been what old poets called danger. We call it pride. You are offended by the masculine itself, the loud, eruptive, possessive thing, the gold lion, the bearded bull, which breaks through hedges and scatters the little kingdom of your primness as the dwarf scattered the carefully made bed. The male you could have escaped, for it exists only on the biological level. But the masculine none of us can escape. What is above and beyond all things is so masculine that we are all feminine in relation to it. You had better agree with your adversary quickly."
"You mean I shall have to become a Christian?" said Jane.
"It looks like it," said the director.
"But I still don't see what that has to do with Mark," said Jane.
This was perhaps not perfectly true. The vision of the universe which he had begun to see in the last few minutes had a curiously stormy quality about it. It was bright, darting, and overpowering. Old Testament imagery of eyes and wheels, for the first time in her life, took on some possibility of meaning. And mixed with this was the sense that she had been manoeuvred into a false position. It ought to have been she who was saying these things to the Christians. Hers ought to have been the vivid, perilous world brought against their grey, formalized one, hers the quick, vital movements, and theirs the stained-glass attitudes. That was the antithesis she was used to. This time, in a sudden flash of purple and crimson, she remembered what stained glass was really like. And where Mark stood in all this new world she did not know, certainly not quite in his old place. Something which she liked to think of as the opposite of Mark had been taken away. Something civilized, or modern, or scholarly, or, of late, spiritual, which did not want to possess her, which valued her for the odd collection of qualities she called herself, something without hands that gripped and without demands upon her. But if there were no such thing? Playing for time, she asked, "Who was that huge woman?"
"I'm not sure," said the director, "but I think I can make a guess. Did you know that all the planets are represented in each?"
"No, sir, I didn't."
"Apparently they are. There is no Oyase in heaven who has not got his representative on earth. And there is no world where you could not meet a little unfallen partner of our own Black Archon, a kind of other self. That is why there was an Italian Saturn as well as a heavenly one, and a Cretan Jove as well as an Olympian. It was these earthly wraiths of the high intelligences that men met in old times when they reported that they had seen the gods. It was with those that a man like Merlin was, at times, conversant. Nothing from beyond the moon ever really descended. What concerns you more, there is a terrestrial as well as a celestial Venus, Perelandra's wraith as well as Perelandra."
"And you think?"
"I do. I have long known that this house is deeply under her influence. There is even copper in the soil. Also, the Earth Venus will be specially active here at present. For it is tonight that her heavenly archetype will really descend."
"I had forgotten," said Jane.
"You will not forget it once it has happened. All of you had better stay together, in the kitchen, perhaps. Do not come upstairs. Tonight I will bring Merlin before my masters, all five of them, Viritribia, Perelandra, Malacandra, Glund, and Lurga. He will be opened. Powers will pass into him."
"Or what will he do, sir?"
The director laughed. "The first step is easy. The enemies at Belbury are already looking for experts in archaic Western dialects, preferably Celtic. We shall send them an interpreter. Yes, by the splendor of Christ, we will send them one. Upon them he, in a spirit of frenzy, sent to call in haste for their destroyer. They have advertised in the papers for one. And after the first step, well, you know, it will be easy. In fighting those who serve devils, one always has this on one side. Their masters hate them as much as they hate us. The moment we disable the human pawns enough to make them useless to hell, their own masters finish the work for us. They break their tools." There was a sudden knock on the door, and Grace Ironwood entered.
"Ivy is back, sir," she said. "I think you'd better see her."
"No, she's alone. She never saw her husband. The sentence is over, but they haven't released him. He's been sent on to Belbury for remedial treatment, under some new regulation. Apparently it does not require a sentence from a court." but she's not very coherent. She is in great distress.
6. Jane had gone into the garden to think. She accepted what the director had said, yet it seemed to her nonsensical. His comparison between Mark's love and God's, since apparently there was a God, struck her nascent spirituality as indecent and irreverent. Religion ought to mean a realm in which her haunting female fear of being treated as a thing, an object of barter and desire and possession, would be set permanently at rest, and what she called her true self would soar upwards and expand in some freer and purer world. For still she thought that religion was a kind of exhalation or a cloud of incense, something steaming up from specially gifted souls towards a receptive heaven. Then, quite sharply, it occurred to her that the director never talked about religion, nor did the Dimbles, nor Camilla. They talked about God. They had no picture in their minds of some mist steaming upward, rather of strong, skilful hands thrust down to make and mend, perhaps even to destroy. Supposing one were a thing, after all, a thing designed and invented by someone else, and valued for qualities quite different from what one had decided to regard as one's true self. Supposing all those people who, from the bachelor uncles down to Mark and Mother Dimble, had infuriatingly found her sweet and fresh when she wanted them to find her also interesting and important, had all along been simply right, and perceived the sort of thing she was. Supposing Maleldil on this subject agreed with them, and not with her. For one moment she had a ridiculous and scorching vision of a world in which God himself would never understand, never take her with full seriousness. Then, at one particular corner of the gooseberry patch, the change came. What awaited her there was serious to the degree of sorrow and beyond. There was no form nor sound. The mould under the bushes, the moss on the path, and the little brick border were not visibly changed. But they were changed. A boundary had been crossed. She had come into a world, or into a person, or into the presence of a person. Something expectant, patient, inexorable, met her with no veil or protection between. In the closeness of that contact, she perceived at once that the director's words had been entirely misleading. This demand which now pressed upon her was not even by analogy like any other demand. It was the origin of all demands, and contained them. In its light you could understand them, but from them you could know nothing of it. There was nothing, and never had been anything like this. And now there was nothing except this. Yet also, everything had been like this. Only by being like this had anything existed. In this height and depth and breadth, the little idea of herself, which she had hitherto called me, dropped down and vanished, unfluttering, into bottomless distance, like a bird in a space without air. The name me was the name of a being whose existence she had never suspected, a being that did not yet fully exist, but which was demanded. It was a person, not the person she had thought, yet also a thing, a made thing, made to please another, and in him to please all others. A thing being made at this very moment, without its choice, in a shape it had never dreamed of. And the making went on amidst a kind of splendour or sorrow or both, whereof she could not tell whether it was in the moulding hands or in the kneaded lump. Words take too long. To be aware of all this, and to know that it had already gone, made one single experience. It was revealed only in its departure. The largest thing that had ever happened to her had, apparently, found room for itself in a moment of time too short to be called time at all. Her hand closed on nothing but a memory, and as it closed, without an instant's pause, the voices of those who have not joy rose howling and chattering from every corner of her being. "Take care, draw back, keep your head, don't commit yourself," they said. And then, more subtly, from another quarter, "You have had a religious experience. This is very interesting. Not everyone does. How much better you will now understand the 17th-century poets." Or from a third direction, more sweetly, "Go on, try to get it again. It will please the director." But her defences had been captured, and these counter-attacks were unsuccessful.